You're listening to the Prepared Homestead Podcast, equipping you to build a self-sufficient homestead in uncertain times.
We're your hosts, Sean and Monica Mitzel, coming to you from Sovereign Sunrise Permafarm in the mountains of northern Idaho. We're glad you're with us.
On today's podcast, we are going to be taking listener questions. So this is something, it's not that we get a ton of listener questions, but we have gotten quite a few.
Yep.
Each one of us over the last, say month or two.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to do that today. But first, through our Success Through Action segment, we want to talk about how it is a great time to start looking towards 2016, start mapping out your goals and objectives for 2016. If you're not at least thinking about them by now, you should be. If not, writing them down. It's also a really good time
to evaluate 2015, what your successes have been, maybe your failures and what you could have done differently or what you did right.
Right. And even if you didn't write down goals for 2015, then you probably still at least have an idea of what you're trying to accomplish. Maybe it's as simple as, oh yeah, well, I meant to have all those different projects done by now. But they, you know, they're not done.
Yeah, like now, a garbage disposal or something like that.
Right. Now, I don't have that problem.
Right.
I got everything done.
Everything.
Everything.
Yeah, that's
including
true.
Garbage disposals.
Including garbage disposals.
In 2015.
It will be done in 2015. That's right. I just sat for a couple of months. It's okay.
Anyway, that's not important.
But if you didn't write down goals for 2015, let that be a lesson for 2016. And actually do write down goals, because it's hard to track successes when you don't even know what you're aiming for.
Right. So we probably will be talking about goal setting a little bit more over
the next
couple weeks.
Yeah.
Or the next couple podcasts anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to get into our main topic for today, which again is listener questions. So we're going to just take these in turns. Questions that were asked either kind of to both of us or each one of us.
Yeah.
In turn. I think I'll start.
Okay.
I got a question that says, do you participate in amateur radio? In other words, do we engage in ham radio specifically? That's what is meant by amateur radio. And the answer to that question is not yet. However, what we do is we use FRS, GMRS radios all the time. That's again, those are just your standard radios that you can buy and use. We use them on the homestead all the time. But there's also what's called the Channel 3 project, where you can tie in with these regular radios that people use all the time into the ham network. Okay, that's important. But the bottom line is that is something that we have a desire to do.
Yeah, and maybe
we will become certified.
Set it as a goal this next year.
Yeah.
Because in 2015, we actually did intend on doing that several times through 2015, but we constantly found ourselves engulfed with other projects and other things that we were working on. There were so many things we wanted to accomplish this year, and we hadn't written that down as a goal.
Right. And bottom line is other priorities took precedence.
Yeah, and it is important. As a prepared homestead, you should have a really good communications network.
Yes, and in fact, we definitely plan on expanding that, of course, through ham radio, but also trying to establish at least a local network with neighbors and local community. So that is something that we're looking to very soon.
Yeah.
How about you?
Okay, well, we're going to move into the kitchen now then, because that's where a lot of my questions seem to center. So one of the questions that I have actually got asked a lot is, can you use jars from store-bought items to do canning at home? And that answer is actually, you can, yes, you can, but you have to be very careful, because the jars that are used commercially are generally not as thick and they're not intended for that high pressure that you would be doing at home. The other issue is that a lot of times the tops of the jars are going to be thinner, so they'll have not as good of a seal that you would have in a, you know, a mason style jar or whatever. So you have two things. You may lose food when you're putting it into a pressure canner and the jar explodes.
Okay.
In the pressure canner. Or it makes it through the pressure canner, but afterwards it didn't seal correctly and it's sitting on your shelf. And when you go to get it out, it's rotten. So all in all, they don't recommend doing that. But if you can find one that is the exact same size, it doesn't have any nicks or anything, and you want to take the chance, you can. But it's not recommended by the USDA.
Okay.
And I don't recommend it, really.
Got it. All right. Next question. Do you process your own hogs? Great question. It's actually the one animal that we did not process ourselves.
Not that he didn't want to.
Yes, she wouldn't let me.
Right.
Now, in fairness, it's because we have not acquired the skill of curing and smoking yet.
Right. So, and I like bacon.
Yeah, absolutely. So for this year, we decided, okay, for that, we're just going to send that to the to a processor. Mm-hmm. And they did a great job, and the curing and smoking and all that work. So we're really enjoying that. We do process all of our other animals ourselves, so the sheep, goats, ducks, chickens,
turkeys,
rabbits, etc.
Deer.
So again, we do all of our own processing, and we plan on adding that next year. We want to do our own hogs. So we're going to have to learn. That's going to have to be one of our goals, is to learn the skill of curing,
yeah,
and smoking.
Well, and learning the different cuts, because you want to have good bacon cuts and
absolutely
all of
so
that.
So one of the things we've become actually very proficient with birds, and we do that for customers. We do lots of chickens and ducks and turkeys and all of that. What we're not particularly skilled at yet, but learning, is in your bigger cuts. So you start with your primal cuts, and then you get down to your smaller cuts with whether you're talking goats, sheep,
yeah,
and then of course pigs,
yeah,
as well. So that's something that we're still trying to get to the next level.
Yeah, skill-wise. It's just so much learning in 1 year how to butcher all different types of animals, and we have a great book, Butchering 101, that we really love.
Yes,
that we recommend definitely if you're trying to learn how to butcher your own animals. Okay, so another question. This is, again, back to canning. Do I really need a pressure canner if I have a water bath canner? Yes. If you plan on canning anything that is non-acidic, that means meat, vegetables, broth.
So basically anything beyond jams,
beans,
and jellies.
Yes, you can do jams, jellies, pie fillings, salsas, or any kind of tomato product that you've added lemon or vinegar to. Everything else requires a pressure canner. It has to be up to a certain temperature for a certain amount of time, and a water bath canner will never do that for you.
Okay. All right. Next question I got was actually somebody from Australia. And what they laid out for me, and I don't have time to do that right now. Essentially, under their law, which is very restrictive, what would I recommend for home defense? And you have to understand that it is very restrictive there. So in other words, no semi-automatic weapons at all. Not even pump shotguns are allowed by your average citizen. So after this person explained to me what was allowed, and again, it's very restrictive, it came really down to over and under shotguns as the best one. There are some lever action items that they can own. But what I ended up recommending was an over and under shotgun. Now, in any case that you have more options than that, then obviously that's not what I would recommend. But that can be a perfectly good home defense tool. An over and under shotgun, essentially you get two shots, and then it's breech loaded, so you got to break down the breech, reload, and then you're back in business. So what I told this person is, hey, I would go with that over and under shotgun, good reliable shotgun, like a Mossberg. And believe it or not, a lot of manufacturers make all these, and obviously they're specific to Australia. Nobody in the United States buys them because they have pump action and semi-auto shotguns. But any firearm is better than no firearms for home defense. And an over and under shotgun with good training, good ability to reload that quickly, be able to do that in the dark, half awake, would make for a perfectly fine self-defense, home firearm. So that's kind of what I recommended. But again, you got to base it on what are the restrictions in your area. Now, just as an underlying assumption, I don't believe that any government should restrict your ability to defend yourself or your home.
Yeah.
But that's just not the reality of people who are living in that situation. So, you know, with that said, within the laws of where you're at, it would change. In his case, it was an over and under shotgun, and that's certainly better than nothing.
Yeah, that's pretty sad, but that's great that they can at least have something.
Yes.
Okay, so the next question is, what is bone broth and how do I make it? Okay, bone broth, first of all, is different than the chicken broth or the turkey broth or any of that you're going to get in the store. That is laden with MSG, probably made from animal parts that animal was kept, you know, in very unsanitary conditions and probably fed a lot of stuff that you wouldn't even want to ingest. And the thing is, when you're doing a bone broth, you're literally trying to pull all the essence or the nutrients or anything out of that bone. So if you're starting with an animal that has been fed a lot of antibiotics or GMO feed or whatever, you're getting all of that in the broth. So you don't want that. You want to start out with some good stuff. But this stuff, it boosts your immune system. It's an excellent source of minerals, and it improves your digestion. It's good for your bones and your teeth. And this is the traditional stuff when they say, oh, have chicken soup when you're sick. The reason this helps is because it actually has all the calcium and all the minerals and the immune boosters in the soup. Yeah. We don't generally make it like that anymore.
Right. So it's kind of funny when people talk about, like, it's even today, you'll hear if somebody's sick, they say, oh, yeah, I need to get some chicken soup. Well, if you're going to buy it from the store, it's like a pointless endeavor, you know.
Yeah, you may as well just drink, I mean, anything. Gatorade, it'll be exactly the same thing. So how you make bone broth, starting out with, you know, with a good source. And for us, we start out with with chicken feet and heads that we get from the animals that we process. Yeah. Pasture raised, chickens, turkeys, and even ducks. You can use the carcasses as well. After you're done roasting it, you can take the carcass and throw it into the water. You're going to get the most gelatinous and the most nutritious stuff from the neck, the head, and the feet. And you will have to simmer this pot for at least 24 hours if it's chicken. Chicken or, you know, any kind of poultry. If you're dealing with beef, you're looking at about 48 hours.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a long time, but if you put a little bit of vinegar in the water and then whatever vegetable ends or extras you have or herbs you feel like throwing in, garlic or onion or whatever, cover it with water and let that simmer for a good 24 hours. And the bones will literally be soft. I mean, they will no longer be even holding up to, you know, pressure when you try to break it. That's when you know that all the good stuff and all the nutrition has gotten into the broth. It is different than even making a chicken broth. Sometimes I'll take, you know, a carcass and throw it in and let it simmer for 4 hours, and the meat kind of falls off, the extra meat, and that flavors it. But that is not fully going on to a bone broth. A bone broth does require at least a 24-hour simmer.
Very cool. So that is what was meant when someone was sick and they say, drink chicken noodle soup. They were assuming bone broth.
Yeah, and that's
the stock of the soup.
Yeah, and that used to really be a staple in kitchens, because that was a really good way to add extra nutrition to the family for very, very inexpensively.
Right, and now you're utilizing the whole animal.
The whole thing.
You don't just throw away all the bones. You're basically using it again.
Exactly.
And getting all that, the curative and nutritional properties from
it. Yeah, and you know, they even say that it can help arthritis and other issues with your joints because of the collagen that is found as you draw all of that out into the broth.
Right. You see all the over-the-counter medicines for arthritis, and when it really comes down to it,
it's increasing the collagen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's good stuff right there. I mean, that's something anybody could do, really.
Anybody. Yes.
I mean, even if you're not raising them yourself, if you're getting good, you have a good source
yep.
of meat or even the bones or the head or the feet.
Yep. Of some pasture-raised animals. Yep.
All right. Okay, so next question, how do you store fuel? Okay, so this can become an extensive subject, but to keep it very simple, what is important to understand is that fuel stores very differently, and it depends on the environment that you're in. Obviously, if it's subject to extreme heat and cold, it can reduce its shelf life, if you will. But generally speaking, your regular gasoline will store for, say, up to about 6 months before it starts losing some of its combustibility and properties. Now, diesel fuel traditionally stored for a whole lot longer. However, now that they're using this the low sulfur stuff, its shelf life is actually reduced as well. Okay, so essentially it's like this. If you want to store gasoline or diesel and you want to do it for more than 6 months, you need to add additives. Okay, something like Stabil or something that's going to that you can put in the diesel or whatever. It's an antifungal type additives. And if kept in a kind of a cool, consistent, dark, dry place, then you can probably get up to about 2 years.
Oh, wow.
Of storage. Okay? That's just the real basics of it as far as storing fuel. Now, how do you do it? Well, we don't all have these 500-gallon tanks, you know, that are elevated on a platform that we can gravity feed our vehicles from, etc. So a very simple way to do it is just to get your basic 5-gallon gas cans, however much you want. Let's say you want 10 of them. Okay, if you have 10 of them, then obviously you could store 50 gallons of fuel. Okay, now, and then if you lay out those 10 5-gallon gas cans and then rotate them. This is really important because you do want to keep, you don't want to just throw them in a corner, forget about them, and then, you know, the power finally goes out a year later and then you start using them and then you realize, wow, I'm really losing some combustibility with this. So you want to be careful of that and start a rotation. If you can do something simple like number each one of those gas cans, set up a simple system that you can use to rotate. So every month, say you'd use additives, so you know you can get a good solid year or two at least. But you rotate every month, you use at least one of those 5-gallon gas cans, goes into the vehicle, and then gets refilled. And then that goes into the stack again. And if you have that rotation, then at least every 10 months, all of your fuel is being rotated. And that would keep you well within that guideline of 2 years if you're using additives. If you're not, then you want to make that rotation faster. Okay, so you can still keep 50 gallons, not use additives, but you'll just have to do that rotation faster. So maybe it's, you know, you're going to put in 3 gas cans a month into your vehicles, refill them, and that way every 3 months or so, just over 3 months, you have rotated all your fuel. So that would be a simple way to do it. Now, getting beyond that, if you're going to use large containers, then you need to kind of think that through as far as how you're going to draw that fuel down. Maybe it's you have 2 large containers filled, and maybe you can get a discount on gas if you buy a lot that way, and then you use that to draw down. And once that one's all the way down, that gets refilled, and then you switch to the other one. Okay, but you have to really keep track of this. The other thing I'll say as far as fuel storage, if you can find non-ethanol fuel, you want to at least store some of that. All of your small equipment, your lawnmowers, your chainsaws, especially your generators, do better on non-ethanol fuel, especially chainsaws. So I know my chainsaw runs terribly if there's any ethanol fuel, and if non-ethanol fuel, it runs great. Okay, and that's just how they're made. They're not made for the ethanol fuel. It's harder on the smaller components. They get gummed up. Okay, so those are some basics of fuel storage.
Okay. That's a lot of information. You know, I just want to ask a really quick question about fuel in the generator. So, like, if you got fuel in the generator, should you drain that down, like, drain it out and let it sit without gas in it? Or do you put gas in it and keep gas in and just run the generator occasionally? Or
no, that's actually a good question. You definitely want to run your equipment. And that's why I've talked about this before, is having a maintenance day. A day that you, whether you need to or not, you start up all your small equipment, including your generators, chainsaws, everything. Because you don't want that stuff to just sit for 6 months, 9 months, or whatever. As far as keeping fuel in vehicles or generators or anything else, there's a couple schools of thought. Number one, you empty them all the way out. That way they don't get gummed up or anything else. And that's fine. But a better way, I think, is actually keeping them full. Starting them regularly and keeping them full. Now, what you can do with a generator that has a carburetor is you'll start it, let it run for your maintenance day for, say, 10 or 15 minutes, let it work itself out, and then turn the fuel off and let it basically die. So it's going to run until all the fuel runs out of the carburetor, and then it's going to die, turn the fuel, you know, and then you can store it like that. That way nothing gets gummed up in the carburetor.
Okay, so the next question that I have gotten quite a bit is, do I need a yogurt maker in order to make yogurt? And my answer there is absolutely not. And as a matter of fact, I'm the kind of person that likes to, maybe this is a permaculture kitchen thing, I don't know, but to put everything I have to multiple use. Everything in the kitchen should not just have one job. And if it does, there's got to be something else that can do its job along with other things. I don't like the kitchen to be crowded with items that, you know, I can't use for multiple purposes. Yogurt maker is definitely one of those things. Can I make yogurt without a yogurt maker? Yeah, I can make it in my dehydrator, which I use my Excalibur to do that. When I first learned to make yogurt, the lady that taught me how to make it just homesteady, she put it in a big giant pot next to her wood stove, and it made perfectly good Greek yogurt the next day. You can do it in simmering water. You can do it in a low oven. You don't need a yogurt maker. And from what I've seen in my experience with people who end up getting those types of things, they'll use it once or twice, maybe three times, and then it dies off. And because it isn't a multi-purpose tool, it ends up shoved way back into a cupboard or sold at some garage sale because they're just not using it. So I just say stay away from yogurt makers. Figure out how to make it with tools and with things you already have in your kitchen.
Very good. Awesome. Okay, next question was basically a question about, hey, do you have a checklist for a bug out bag? Okay, so or some type of a list. If somebody was going to bug out from their location to their bug out location because of whatever, I don't care if, you know, major natural disaster and they're going to just get out of the area, do I have a checklist for that? Well, and although that seems like a simple question where you can just say, oh yeah, here's a checklist right here, just get everything on the checklist and you'll be good. And of course, there's many of those out there online where you can find lists upon lists of things like that. But here's the problem with that. There's a lot of factors involved, and there's a lot of questions to be answered other than just where's the checklist for a bug out location. So, you know, what is that person, is the best thing for them to bug out and not bug in? What's the bug out location like? How far are you from it? And for how many people are you talking about? Are there water sources there? Is there anything pre-staged there? And, you know, can you always count on being able to move? In other words, it's like, oh, well, I have everything I need there. Okay, where's there and how are you going to get there? Unfortunately, I think you have to plan for a couple of things. Your current location, your vehicle, and if you do have some other location that you're going to have supplies at, you have to plan for all three. And I would have a basic food and water, communication, security for each location. Okay, something that you can take with you. So in other words, you could have a go bag for each member of your family. If that was, say you live in the city and you have a place or a family or whatever that's out of the city, and it's like, well, if there was any type of civil unrest or any big natural disaster, and then we're all going to go to grandma's house. Well, okay. Then everybody needs to have a bag packed with some extra food, you know, with some extra changes of clothes, you know, just some basics like that. Maybe even a small amount of medical gear. You got to have security for you and your family. And I would say 3 days worth is a good number to work with. So in other words, if everybody had an independent bag where they could subsist for 3 days, that would be ideal. Every member of your family. Now, in addition to that, I'd have another large go bag so that everybody could grab their individual backpack, and then you could grab this large go bag. Okay, or maybe two large go bags. How hard would that be if you had to go right now, if everybody had their backpack, two large bags get thrown into the vehicle and off you go, and you're doing pretty well. Now, the large go bag could be extra food, it could be water, it could be filters, it could be medical supplies, it could be extra clothes, all those kinds of basics. It could be some basic tools, which probably should be in your vehicle anyway, you would be able to go with. So I would even suggest you have supplies at your location, your bug out location, if you want to use that term. So I don't care if it's grandma's house. Well, go make sure grandma's nice and stocked up and she's got what she needs plus some. So in other words, don't have all your eggs in one basket. Water is always going to be the challenge because, you know, it's going to be hard to store a bunch of water in each backpack and each go bag. But you can certainly make an arrangement for that. You should be able to take some water, a little bit, but certainly a filter. And because the likelihood, if you're in a natural disaster, of finding clean water is not very high. Mm-hmm. You know, you could have dirty water out there. In the case of Hurricane Katrina, the problem was not water. The problem was clean water.
Right.
Okay. Now, if those people didn't have the bottled water show up for them, they would have been probably getting dysentery and everything else in short order. Okay. So make sure you have a way to filter that water in all three locations. It's not going to hurt you to have a water filter in each one of those bags, or maybe it's in the big bags or in your vehicle, et cetera. And having a winter kit specifically for now, but even just a regular vehicle kit is a great idea in any case. So multiple sources, consider your location, consider how far you have to go. Obviously fuel is a factor. If you know you've got to go 200 miles, you can't, and you say, well, yeah, half a tank gives me 200 miles, no problem. Well, you can't count on that. In a time of natural disaster, you might not be able to go with your primary route.
Right. It might take you 6 hours, or you might get stuck in traffic.
Exactly. It might take you 6 hours. You might have to go around. You may have to go on a secondary or a tertiary route that might take you triple the time and the distance. So you have to think through all those things. You don't want to rely on just, you know, it's like, well, I'm going to go from here to there and it's going to work out and everything's fine.
Best case scenario.
Yeah, you can't do that. You have to have a primary, secondary, and a tertiary plan. You always want to have some cash with you. I recommend if your bug out location is 200 miles away, and let's say that you're pretty good about it, you always, anytime you get down to half a tank of gas, you're always filling up. Well, that's great. But you also need to be able to throw in a little bit of gas with you if you're going to go. Okay. So I don't have a checklist because there's too many factors involved. Yeah, you can find those online. No problem. But you really the better thing to do there is to really think through your situation and just what if it, even if it, you know, just for fun, sit around the kitchen, the table at dinner time and come up with a scenario. What if we had to leave in 5 minutes? What would you guys grab? How would we do it? And where would we go? And you know, just have fun with it, with the family. And then you could start going, well, you know what? Maybe we should have those things taken care of or at least planned for. Okay, so like I said, having those secondary and tertiary evacuation routes are really important too. So don't forget about that. And then the other thing, the last thing I'll say is that if you are really going to bug out, something that bad happens, make that decision early.
Yeah.
Don't hesitate. Don't wait, because it's not going to be long before those roads are packed and everything.
You have to see things before other people are really seeing them. You have to be aware of what's going on. We talk to our family in the city a lot about this, and you have to be ahead of the game, because by the time everyone knows, it's going to be too late for you to leave.
Absolutely.
You're going to get stuck. Okay. So I talked a little bit about yogurt. So I'm moving on to this because it's kind of related. And this is a question I get a lot too, is I want to dehydrate food. I want to be able to do that. Is getting a cheap dehydrator okay? Or should I spend the money and invest in an Excalibur? Because that's the one I really recommend. A cheap dehydrator is going to do one job for you. And this goes back to the multi-purpose tools in the kitchen. It's going to be great. I do have a cheap dehydrator that does, you know, my fruits and fruit leathers really, really well. My Excalibur, however, not only dehydrates my fruit and vegetables, but it also helps my yogurt. I can rise my bread in there if the kitchen is cold. You can keep things warm. You can do jerky. It has all different levels.
So if I want to chicken eggs,
yes, we even hatched chicken eggs in there, and it worked. It worked better than our.
It's an impromptu incubator.
Yeah, it was an incubator. What's great about it is the trays are removable, and so if you only need to use one or two trays, you can put those in there. If you've got thicker items, with the cheaper ones, you have a very limited amount of space. With the Excalibur, you can decide to skip a tray and put more above there. So it gives you much more versatility and many more options. It also has a fan that comes from the back, and it hits every single tray evenly, whereas the cheaper ones generally come from the top or from the bottom. And it'll, you know, dry the ones that are closest to the fan very quickly, and the ones that are farthest from the fan will take a lot longer. So the Excalibur gives an even drying for all of your food that's in there, which is really helpful.
Very good. Okay, a question I get a lot is, what kind of firearm should I buy? You know, what's the right weapon? And it's questions like that. All right, so anyone who tells you, oh, you want to buy a firearm, go buy this firearm, turn around and walk away. Because it depends. And there's a lot of different factors. And the firearms has to be right for you. Okay, so I could sit here and recommend, oh, yeah, you got to go with these Springfield XDs, the series. These things are awesome. And I do think they're awesome. And I have a Springfield XD, and I love it. However, that might not be the right firearm for somebody else.
Like me.
Like you. I mean, okay, so it depends. I mean, what are you, left-handed or right-handed? Okay, some firearms are ambidextrous all the way through. It's no problem using them. Some are a little bit more difficult to use for lefties. Okay? So those are the types of things you need to think about as one aspect. The second aspect is, you know, are you going to actually train with that firearm? Okay? So whatever firearm you buy, it has to be something you're willing and able to train with. Okay? Some people will buy these big firearms, so they want large caliber handguns, etc., but then it hurts them to shoot it. Well, if they're not going to train with it, it's not going to be a very effective tool for them. So I always recommend to say, okay, you have to buy something that not only works dexterity-wise for you, and again, a lot of that's based on left-handed, right-handed, can you pull the slide back? Some firearms, the action is easier to manipulate than others. And that's a factor for people who may have arthritis, or maybe they're getting older. Maybe they're female and they're not that strong.
Thanks, babe.
Or male and they're not that strong. So, you know, whatever the case. And that's okay, because we deal and work within our limitations. Okay, so dexterity-wise, you have to be able to manipulate that slide. You got to be able to take the safety on and off if it has an external safety. You have to be able to break the weapon down and clean it. But you have to be able to train with it too. So it's got to be the right right as far as that is concerned as well. You want something that I always recommend if they think about the cost. Okay, you couldn't buy a really expensive firearm, but even beyond the initial price tag is how much does it cost to shoot that? So people who buy a 380, for example, they go, well, it doesn't kick as much depending on if it's full size or compact. But it's actually more expensive to shoot a 380 than it is a 9mm, for example. Okay, that's just a small thing, but over hundreds and thousands of rounds, that really adds up. Okay, so think through that. And I just mentioned it, size. So a full-size weapon versus a subcompact or a compact. The smaller you get, the more recoil you're going to have from the weapon. So you have a lot of people who say, oh, yeah, I'm going to buy this compact, whatever. And it ends up being not fun for them to shoot. And it goes back into they won't train with it because it's not fun to shoot. You know, it hurts. It hurts to fire. So think through those things. So even when I teach people concealed carry as far as permitting is concerned, a lot of times I'll recommend that they go with a full size or maybe just a compact firearm because I know that they're going to actually train with that weapon. Mm-hmm. If they go with the subcompact, say, look at that. Nobody can see it. It's really easy to conceal. It's like, well, yeah, but if you're not going to use it, then it's not going to be an effective tool. So you have to take all those things into consideration. So with all that being said, what I recommend that people buy is a firearm that feels good in their hand, that is a decent caliber, that they think through the money cost, that they are willing and able to train with it, so it means that they have tried it out prior to purchasing it, that they are able to manipulate the firearm, that they have good dexterity with it, they can move the slide back and forth nice and easy, they can put the weapon on and off safe if it's applicable, and they can lock the slide to the rear. They can do all those things rather easily, or they've been trained to do them to overcome certain areas, and that's fine too. But you've got to be able to do all those things. So as far as that is this a Sig Sauer? Is this a Glock? Is this a Springfield? Those things are important. Just basically, you want a reliable firearm. Okay, so any of those are great, but even if you don't go with one of those models, I know lots of people who have had a Taurus, which doesn't have a great reputation, but they're like, I've never had a double feed. I've never had a malfunction at all. Well, okay, great. If it's reliable, if you can manipulate the weapon, if it's affordable to shoot and you're training with it, then it's a good firearm.
It's my turn now. See, I keep going, like, I go back to the kitchen, and I'm, like, saying all these, and you're, like, all high speed over there talking about your cool guns and weapons and all this stuff. Anyway, now we're going to talk about wheat berries.
Nice.
Okay. So,
this is important stuff. Seriously.
Well, it is. When we moved out here, a little over a year ago, I had been making homemade bread for a while, and I had even ground my own wheat and things, but I hadn't really paid that close of attention. My bread didn't turn out very consistent, and I never really knew why. It wasn't something that I had studied intimately. This last year, I really have studied it a lot and have discovered many of the mistakes that I made before and why, scientifically, I didn't get the consistent bread that I was hoping for. So when I talk to people about what kind of wheat berries they should use, because there are several out there, there's a soft white, there's a hard white, hard red spring, and hard red winter, like a winter wheat. Now, the difference between the spring and the winter are minimal, and that's something that I could talk about later. But right now, the two primaries that you want to look at is the soft white will do your baked goods, like cookies, quick breads, pancakes, waffles, anything like that that is using a different kind of leavener than a regular loaf of bread. The reason those are useful for that, the soft white, is that it has a lower gluten level. So it's not going to rise the same as a hard white or a hard red wheat will. So if you're going to be making bread and you want a regular loaf of like sandwich bread, you're going to be looking at a hard white. And that's really great if you're trying to switch your family from store-bought bread to homemade bread. Switching to a hard red immediately, where it's really dense and nutty and completely different than anything you're going to get in the store, is probably going to cause like a culture shock. And everyone's going to be like, no, I like my store-bought bread. But if you switch them over to a hard white, it's going to look very similar to a store-bought bread. It looks white. So they kind of feel like, oh, I'm eating a similar loaf of bread to what I would, you know, what we would buy the white bread in the store. It also has a lighter texture and will, if you, as long as you knead it enough, almost make a really nice light sandwich bread. Whereas the hard reds tend to be a little denser. And I know there's a lot of people out there that really appreciate the texture of a hard red wheat berry bread. It's the typical, what everybody imagines wheat bread to be like, a very dense and kind of nutty taste. So if you're trying to have that kind of bread, you'll want to use the hard reds. But a really good combo that I'm pretty happy with is mostly hard white with some hard red thrown in. And it makes still a pretty light bread while still having a nutty texture and enough of the gluten that makes a really nice slice and doesn't get too dry. So,
very good.
Those are my recommendations.
Okay. All right. So I think that covers it. Those are all the questions that we're going to cover today. The one thing I want to mention before we sign off here is our internet consulting. So we've mostly what we've done up to this point is we've consulted with clients on their properties, you know, from a permaculture and preparedness and a home and family protection perspective. But we have also are launching this as an online service as well. So in other words, we would work with a client. We would work with them. We would get plat maps, topo maps, things like that. I would talk to them about objectives and goals. And then we would work on a consulting basis, basically web-based.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and there's still a lot of things that you can do web-based, based on working with someone.
Yeah.
And other than that, let's see, what do we have coming up? Nothing really as far as we don't plan on doing any workshops or anything like that till probably spring.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Okay. All right. Same thing with processing. Yep. I think that's it then.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
So you can get a hold of us, obviously, on the preparedhomestead.org via the contact sheet there.
Mm-hmm.
All right.